The House Transportation Policy and Regional Governance Committee will come to order. And it's a little bit late. We're going to start at 1 o'clock on the dot after this. But we do have a quorum at this point, so that's good. And I wonder if Representative Carlson has checked out the minutes. I wanted to give you this special privilege because you got me out of a jam this morning on the way in. So you had your card, your badge, and I didn't. So,
Madam Chair, it was my pleasure. No questions on the minutes. Having just previewed the minutes, I will make a motion to approve the minutes.
Okay, Representative Carlson moves approval of the minutes from the January 11th meeting. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The minutes of January 11th are approved. We have a second set of minutes for January 17th. Would you like to keep going, Representative Carlson?
Absolutely. Move to approve the minutes.
Okay, Representative Carlson moves approval of the minutes from January 17th. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Okay. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. And today we have a couple of informational hearings and an opportunity to meet the new commissioner of MAC. So we're excited about that. And are you coming up by yourself then?
I am, yes.
Okay. Great. I just got a chance to meet you. Wonderful to have you here. And just go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony, please.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Brian Ricks. I am the Executive Director and CEO of the Metropolitan Airports Commission. I should have said new Executive Director and CEO of the Metropolitan Airports Commission. I've been, actually, today is my 8th month anniversary, and so I'm glad I've made it the first 8 months, and hopefully I'll make it for many more months in the future. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today and talk a little bit about the Airports Commission. I'm going to cover briefly my background, talk a little bit about the MAC organizational structure today, a little bit about our financial approach and how we do business, touch on air service development, and then finish by giving you some insight on some of the things that we are working at that you'll see and notice as you come through the airport. In the coming year. So with that, I'll go ahead and get started. Here we go. A little bit about myself. I've been in the aviation industry about 31 years. Now I actually started my career off at the Airports Commission as an intern. After that internship, I was retained full-time, where I was responsible for supervising the noise monitoring program, and in that program we hired a number of interns to go out in vans and monitor noise around the communities adjacent to the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. So I was at the MAC for about 4 years. An opportunity arose in 1990 to go out to Denver and be the manager of noise abatement at Stapleton International Airport. And in 1990, Denver had just started the process of constructing a brand new major hub airport, first major hub airport that had been constructed since Dallas-Fort Worth in 1978. And there was an opportunity for me to get involved in a project at that airport and get involved in it. So I was out in Denver for 6 years, stayed there until about a year after the facility opened. But really my career goal and aspiration was to become an airport director, and that basically took me on a track through a number of airports, Aberdeen, South Dakota, St. Cloud, Minnesota, Duluth, Minnesota, Grand Rapids, Michigan, and then back to Minneapolis-St. Paul in May of this year. While I was at St. Cloud and Duluth, I did spend some time down here at the legislature. I was chair of the Minnesota Council of Airports during that time, or a couple of years of that time. And also in Duluth, during my 10 years there, we built a new terminal. And that terminal was partially funded through state bonding dollars. We leveraged about $17 million in state bonding funds. And so I spent a lot of time in committees talking about that project. And the nice thing about it, I think it's a great example of an airport project and state bonding dollars that go to leverage federal dollars. We leveraged more federal dollars, I think it was $47 million, more federal dollars than any other small airport project of its kind in the United States. So kudos to the state. And in participating in that program, that terminal will serve Duluth as their front door for many years to come, and has proven to be a tremendous asset to their community. A little bit about the MAC and how we go about our business. We are a public corporation that was created by the state legislature. Back in 1943, I think the legislature and then Governor Stassen really had a lot of foresight in creating a commission that could be solely responsible for the operation of not only Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, but other airports in the Twin Cities metro area. I think Governor Stassen at that time felt that the geographic location of Minneapolis-St. Paul was an excellent location to build on eventually trying to obtain nonstop service to as many destinations throughout North America as possible. And that dream certainly came true as Northwest Airways first was established, I think, in 1926 and eventually established a home base here in the Twin Cities. And really grew that hub to be a premier hub in the country. Specifically, we are tasked with three things. Number one, promoting air navigation and transportation locally throughout the state, ensuring that the Twin Cities area is competitive in that arena, promote the safe and economical handling of air commerce, and develop the full potentials of aviation in the state of Minnesota. And then thirdly, to assure that our impacts by the operation of Minneapolis and our other airports, the environmental impacts are minimized, and also the noise impacts and the hazards around the facility. And I think we've accomplished that. Minneapolis, as you may know, has, I believe, the most aggressive and comprehensive noise mitigation program in the country. We've spent over $500 million insulating homes, I think 15,000 homes, and 19 schools in six different communities. And we continue continue that program. In 2017, we're scheduled to mitigate another 137 single-family and 88 multifamily homes. So we're committed to that. And we'll continue to be committed to that. We also have the six reliever airports in the Twin Cities area, certainly the system is designed of reliever airports to relieve Minneapolis of some of that corporate and recreational flying, and it works very well. We have a user fee based model, so that if you use the facility, if you use the airport, you help pay for it, and we'll get into that a little bit later. We also have limited property taxing authority that was established, but I can tell you that taxing authority, which is a third of a mil, and extends throughout the includes all the real property in the Twin Cities metro area, has not been used since the 1960s, and frankly, we don't have an intention to use that in the future. So that property taxing authority, however, does provide us a real benefit, and that benefit is many of our projects. How we fund those projects is we issue bonds, and in order having that taxing authority as an ultimate backstop certainly allows us to maintain one of the strongest, actually I think it is the strongest bond rating of any airport in the country. There's only a handful of airports that share that AA- bond rating. So we appreciate having that, but again, are not anticipating the need to use that in the future. Our board composition, the governor appoints our board chairman, and 12 commissioners. Eight of those board members represent the metro area. We have eight districts that are divided up for each board member to represent. They serve four-year staggered terms, and also the mayors of St. Paul and Minneapolis all have a seat, and they typically appoint someone. Our board has been very effective. They take their role seriously. They do their work. They read their agendas. They read their material and get involved at a very detailed level. I think the fact that we have four-year staggered terms is a benefit. It's a benefit in that when there's a change in the governor, we do not have a wholesale change in our board, and that's important to us because airports are unique business models. And we typically have projects that extend over multiple years, and to have consistency amongst those commissioners really is a tremendous benefit when we're into those types of projects and infrastructure developments throughout our facility. A little more detail on our organizational structure. We obviously report to you, the state legislature. The MAC Board of Commissioners is at the top there. We have a system of three committees, a Finance and Administration Committee, a Planning, Development, and Environmental Committee, and a Management and Operations Committee. So items are vetted through that committee structure before they reach the full MAC board. And again, by having that structure, it allows us to do business very efficiently each month as items come forward. I serve as the executive director and CEO and have a number of reports directly to me. Primarily, you will see either myself here or Mitch Killian. Mitch is our director of government affairs, and Mitch works, who is here with us today. Mitch works both at the state and federal level, so Mitch is very active and extremely respected, not only at the state here, but also amongst the federal ranks. I have a chief operating officer, Denny Probst, who has really the responsibility of the day-to-day option, and there's four primary VP-level individuals with various individuals underneath each one of them that report to Denny. It's a very effective structure that allows me to focus, again, on the performance and Denny to focus on the day-to-day operation. From a major hub airport standard, we really have a very lean staff, 600 individuals, and if you were to compare other major hub airports around the country, you'd see many more individuals involved in those airports. We operate much like a city. We have our own police department, our own fire department, dispatchers working on site, building inspection departments, planning and development departments, maintenance department. And I'll tell you, the staff that we have, it's a very low turnover. They take pride and are very passionate about the work that they do to ensure that we are providing a safe and secure and customer-friendly operation for all those who either originate or terminate their travel in Minneapolis or connect through the facility. In addition, when you consider all of the jobs at the airport, all of the stakeholders and employers, including airline personnel, concessionaires, ground handling personnel, the TSA, Customs and Border Protection, et cetera, there are over 20,000 jobs directly tied to the Minneapolis operation that are working there every day. Our mission is a global mission connecting you to your world. Our vision is to provide your best airport experience. And then we have seven strategic goals that we really focus on. First and foremost, safety, security, and preparedness, keeping our airport safe and secure. Customer service is a very high priority. We've received some nice awards, and I'll talk about some of the accolades recently, but we are very focused on customer service day in and day out. Air service, I'll talk more about that as well, to kind of grow and enhance our air service wherever possible. From an economic standpoint, we are very fiscally responsible, and also we want to ensure that the economic benefit of the airport is maximized throughout throughout the state. From an engagement standpoint, we are really focused on engaging the communities around our airport. I think that's something that our board and certainly I support moving forward, that we really want to focus more on, and we're doing some things to certainly do that this year that will come out in the coming months. Innovation through opportunities in technology and sustainability is another focus area. I think the Airports Commission was lacking in innovation if you were to look back 5 or 6 years ago, but we've really invested in that area, and we've invested in sustainability. We have a number of projects that have been high-profile projects from a sustainability standpoint. I think the best examples of those projects are the solar installations that have been accomplished at both our Terminal 1 and another one that will be opening up at Terminal 2 in the near future, to really do all we can from a sustainability standpoint. We also have a very robust recycling and reuse program that we're very proud of. And we just recently, our board just recently approved our first sustainability management plan last July. It was the first, we were the first airport in the country to have a web-based sustainability management plan that has, will have a dashboard attached to it. We value our employees' input on sustainability, their thoughts and ideas, and so we're excited to continue to move forward with that. And then finally, from a talent standpoint, to be a model employer by engaging and investing in our workforce and focusing on diversity, inclusion, and equity. Our workforce needs to reflect our community, and not only our workforce, but we're working very hard on including and enhancing diversity and inclusion throughout the products that we purchase and through our construction activities. So much continued focus in those areas. I talked a little bit about our MAX system of airports. Obviously, Minneapolis-St. Paul being the major airport in our system. We have one intermediate airport. That is the St. Paul Downtown Airport, or Holman Field, as it's commonly referred to. And then a number of small airports, starting with Lake Elmo to the east, Anoka County, Blaine Airport to the north, Crystal Airport to the northwest, Flying Cloud Airport to the southwest, and Air Lake to the south. It's a busy system of airports. It accommodates over 1,300, close to 1,350 base aircraft. At when you combine all of the facilities, and we have some expansion projects, some long-term comp plan projects going on at a few of those airports that you may have heard about or may hear about as we go. Really, the busiest airports are St. Paul Downtown when you look at our reliever system, Anoka to the north, and Flying Cloud to the west. So that's really where the majority of the investment has been made in those facilities. From an operations standpoint, when I say operations, I mean landings and takeoffs. If you look at the graph on the left side, you look at back to 2005 was a record year, almost 1.1 million operations, both when you combine Minneapolis and our reliever system of airports. That really, when you look at a daily basis, was about 1,500 operations, landing and takeoffs per day at Minneapolis and at the six reliever airports. You can see the trend. That trend has dropped over the years. We're down to, in 2015, we're down to just over 400,000 operations a day at Minneapolis and about almost 350,000 operations at the reliever airports. The reasons, you can imagine some of the reasons, I'm sure, that those operations have declined. at the reliever airports, it really had to do with the recession, high fuel costs, rise in insurance costs that really led to quite a reduction in both recreational and corporate flying. In Minneapolis, throughout that time, if you go back to 2005, that's the year that Northwest Airlines filed for bankruptcy, so we did see a reduction in the number of flights coming in at that time, really the big drop from 2005 to 2006. But the other thing that the airline industry has been concentrating on over the last decade is consolidation. And with that consolidation, there are less aircraft in the airlines' fleets. And then the other thing that they've been focused on is phasing out the smaller 36-seat turboprop aircraft and 50-seat regional jets. Delta alone used to have about 475 of these 50-seat regional jets. That number is down to about 125 today. So the trend with the major carriers has been less aircraft operations, but those existing aircraft operations, the trend has been to use larger aircraft. That formula actually has worked pretty well for Minneapolis in that larger aircraft, there's been newer technology with those aircraft, more seats, dual-class service that certainly accommodate the business traveler, and less noise because they're newer generation aircraft. The other positive thing about that is that when you compare those 2005 operations at Minneapolis, about 1,500, we're down 350 operations a day today, which means we have a lot of room and a lot of capacity for future growth. And so we're positioned very well when you look out. When you look out to our long-term comp plan, our 2030 long-term comp plan, it identifies about 50 million passengers out to that date. And so the reduction in the number of landings and takeoffs tells us that we'll be able to accommodate that as long as the airlines continue to maintain that type of a pattern with going to a larger aircraft. From a financial standpoint, we take a very conservative approach when we're forecasting our finances. The reason we do that is a couple of reasons. One, we operate as a business, and to operate as a business, we have to be very fiscally responsible. We don't have a backstop. We don't like to rely on that tax levy as a backstop, but we view our only backstop as short-term financing. The other reason is that we are very accountable to the stakeholders that are operating and doing business at the airport, mainly the airlines, and we want to be cost conscious. We want to ensure that their costs are as low as they can be, because if they are as low as they can be, chances are we'll be competitive in adding additional air service in the future. And I think finally, when we look at financing projects out there, we take again a very conservative approach in that when we do our financial forecasting, we do that forecasting based on about 50% of the passengers that are coming through there, or 50% of the passenger revenue that is coming through the facility. And the reason for that is, as you know, Delta is, we are Delta's second largest hub, and about 45% of our total traffic is connecting traffic that, say, starts, someone may start in Florida and connect in Minneapolis to jump on the Haneda flight. And so if anything were ever to happen to the Delta hub, from a financial standpoint, we could still survive and continue on with the project and the infrastructure that we have planned on. We also maintain a six-month reserve to take care of any unforeseen circumstances. And we know in the aviation industry that can happen very quickly. 9/11 is a good example of that. And just a couple of weeks ago, the situation in Fort Lauderdale with the shooting that had a big disruption on that operation obviously. So we want to be very prepared and ensure that if something to that extent were to happen here, that we could handle it from a financial standpoint. Again, we maintain one of the best, if not the best, bond rating in the country with our AA- bond rating. We also carry a small surplus each year. It's just the way we budget and plan and monitor our budget on an annual basis, and that surplus is generally invested back into other projects.
Mr. Reichs, I'm going to stop a moment, and we have a question. Representative Barr.
Thanks, Chair, and thank you to our speaker. One question I had is, you mentioned a six-month reserve. How does that compare to other airports around the country?
Mr. Reichs.
Madam Chair Representative, I think it's typically what you see at airports is anywhere from a 3 to 6 month reserve, and so I think we're right. We're actually to the upper end of that spectrum.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for you. I see in your funding that some of the revenues is collected through airline property and equipment tax. So I'm just curious, what equipment? And I thought that some capital investments, capital improvements are non-taxable. I know in my business, any investment that I have in my capital improvements are non-taxed at the time. So can you clarify that? And then I have a follow-up question after that.
Madam Chair and Representative, and that may look to my having not been in the state for 4 years, but when I was in the state, one of the tax sources to support the state airports fund, Minnesota State Airports Fund, was tax on equipment that the airlines use. So it would be ground handling equipment and those types of things. If that's still that, I believe that's still accurate. That's one of the three main sources of state airports funds funding.
Very good. Yes. And then do you know if the MSP will ever be, if Virgin Atlantic would be able to be at MSP? There's a great airline. If you've ever flown, not that Delta isn't, or Spirit Air, or American Airlines, or any of the others, but Virgin Atlantic is quite something as well.
Mr. Reichs.
Madam Chair and Representative, Virgin America and Alaska just merged, actually, and we are going to see a benefit from that. Alaska has announced that they're going to be adding two flights daily to San Francisco. I believe that starts in June of this year, so we actually are seeing a benefit from that currently. Virgin Atlantic, we meet with on occasion, and we're very interested from an international standpoint as well.
Okay. And please proceed with your presentation.
Kind of to talk a little bit more about the airline industry and how we monitor and take a very conservative approach when we look at our costs that we're charging the airline industry. I wanted to share with a metric with you that's called cost per enplaned passenger, also known as CPE, and it's a common metric throughout the industry. And basically what it is you take all the costs that the airlines pay at your airport, and those costs are landing fees, apron fees, you know, gate fees, ticket counter, seating area fees that we charge back for helping to maintain our facility, and snow removal fees. And you divide the total number of passengers that you're boarding passengers at your facility by the costs that go back to the airlines. And we are in the bottom third, and in fact, I think this Orlando has actually gone up above us since this graphic was generated. But we're in the bottom third. And I think what's even more remarkable is if you look at the airports above us, there's a lot of airports that don't have a major cost that we do, and that's snow removal costs. And so we're very proud to keep this metric low. And why it's obviously important is that when we're looking to develop air service, if we are equal to another airport on the list from a demand standpoint, and that other airport has a higher CPE than we do, the chances of us getting that that air service are much greater. So this is a metric that Minneapolis stands out in. We've maintained this position for many years, and we'll continue to maintain it as we move forward. A little bit more detail about our finances. We generated, we're projected to generate about $354 million in operating revenue this year. That revenue is in four primary areas. Parking and ground transportation makes up about 37%, or about $131 million of that. Airline rates and charges, about 33%, $117 million of that. Other rents and fees, these may be rents that the FAA or the TSA or the Customs and Border Protection or private hangar owners or private businesses that operate on our airports pay. That's about 14% of that value. Concessions is another big business at our facility. We have about 85 food and beverage concessions that operate throughout both Terminal 1 and Terminal 2. We charge them a square footage rate, and then we also receive a percentage of their gross revenue. So those are the primary areas from a revenue standpoint. From an expense standpoint, about $181 million in total expense. The major categories of that really are personnel that make up about 46% of it, maintenance, ongoing maintenance about 21%, operating services about 15%, utilities about 11%, and professional services about 4%. There's a lot of dollars that obviously go through this this facility. You know, one of the things that isn't well known is that obviously we're governed by a lot of federal regulation, mainly the Federal Aviation Administration. The FAA has a what they call grant assurances, so that if we receive a grant to help using federal airport improvement program dollars to participate in a project. We have to sign a whole list of grant assurances, and one of those grant assurances is that any money that is generated on our airfields, whether it's Minneapolis or any one of our reliever airports, that money has to stay on that airfield and be used for operations and maintenance or reinvested into capital projects at the facility. So all of this revenue does stay on the airfield and is reinvested to support future development. I mentioned that we do issue bonds on occasion. We currently have about $1.6 billion in outstanding debt, and that debt service payment is about $101 million, or just over $101 million annually. I think the high the Airports Commission had was about $2.3 billion. That was about 12 years ago in debt when the North-South runway, which opened in 2005, was opened. A few statistics about the facility. We're the 16th busiest airport in North America from a passenger standpoint. We're 15th busiest in North America from an operation standpoint. We're Delta's second largest hub. We're a very profitable hub for Delta. Last fall, after I had been here a few months, I went down and visited with Ed Bastian, the CEO of Delta. I know he was up here just before I started as well, and Mr. Bastian expressed his very strong commitment to Minnesota and the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, referring to it as their second home. Obviously, we have many Fortune 500 companies, more per capita here, I think, than anywhere else, and that is a reason why Delta continues to commit to Minneapolis and grow service both domestic and international in our Twin Cities area. You know, what are people saying about the airport? They're saying some really really good things. We've received many accolades over the years. These are some of the more recent ones. Just over the past past year, we stack up very well nationally. We perform extremely well from an operational standpoint, from an environmental standpoint, from an ease of access and a sustainability, and we have award-winning concessions and award-winning customer service programs. Just you may have heard just announced, I think, yesterday or today, as we are the fifth on the top five highest on-time airports in the world, or one of them. And that's an excellent accolade, obviously, for our air carriers, our personnel that are in charge of snow removal and maintenance at our facility. So very pleased to have received that award. I think we have the opportunity to continue to receive some wonderful awards in that our concessions program is currently being completely redone. We're about half the way through that process in redoing all of our concessions. From a concession standpoint, when someone flies through the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, we want them to get a sense of the Minnesota values and the Minnesota culture and the Minnesota offerings, either through concessions, through retail, or through an art program that has been implemented there. So wonderful accolades moving forward.
So, Mr. Reichs, I'm sure we're all wondering what earned you the America's Best Bathroom Award?
America's Best Bathroom was an award through Cintas Corporation, and we've invested, I think it's about $1 million per bathroom in new bathroom facilities. If you haven't seen them, I would encourage you to visit them. They are expansive. They have new finishes. They have electronic monitoring on them, so if there's dirty or there's an issue, someone can text and let us know. And so we were actually in a competition against Coca-Cola, and it wasn't just airports; it was companies nationwide, and we came out on top. So people are recognizing the wonderful restrooms that we have
right
out there.
Oh well, I'll have to stop in. Please proceed.
Thank you. Moving on to air service development, as I mentioned, we're Delta's second largest hub. We're Sun Country's home base. Delta is currently up to 375 departures per day to 149 nonstop destinations. American and United, with the mergers that they've been through, all have nonstop service to all of their hubs. We've seen tremendous growth in our low-cost carrier industry. Sun Country is now up to 36 destinations. Southwest has grown very rapidly since they entered the market in 2009. They're up to 13 destinations now. And ultra-low-cost carrier Spirit, which started in 2012, is up to 16 destinations. So excellent growth. I mentioned the Alaskas adding a couple of flights to San Fran here in June. But it's not only domestic carriers. We've seen growth with Air France, with Condor going to Frankfurt, and KLM bringing service to Amsterdam back here very soon. So a very robust air service development program. We work very hard. We invest a lot of resources on air service development. But I'm here to tell you we can't do it alone. And we collaborate and partner with many other folks in the Twin Cities area, including Greater MSP, our state chamber, our local area chambers, our destination and marketing organizations, state deed. I just had a meeting with the State International Trade Office last week. So all of those folks are vital partners in us continuing to grow air service opportunities out of Minneapolis. Again, pictorial of the air service added in 2016 and 2017. Ten different airlines actually added a total of 24 additional routes. That's an all-time record for us. And we now enjoy, out of our 155 direct routes, we have competition, meaning more than one airline operating on those routes on 53 of those routes. So that, as we know, competition drives airfares in the right direction. It drives them down, and we've certainly benefited with this additional air service. Little snapshot on passenger records. The all-time record year was back in 2005 when there were about 37.6 million passengers. You can see the decline as we entered into the Northwest bankruptcy and the recession. Certainly brought passenger numbers down. But on a positive note, what we've seen is a very nice growth trend over the last 5 to 6 years. And we expect that to continue. We're forecasting a 2 to 2.25% growth rate here into the planning horizon. We thought we were going to hit an all-time record this year. We started off 2016 with numbers that were about 4%, 3.5 to 4% above last year's numbers, but that did flatten out a little bit in the second half of the year. So it looks like we're just barely going to miss it. I'm going to move into some 2017 highlights that you'll see as you travel through the facility. Some very large projects going on. The first one on the top is really a Terminal 1 ticketing, baggage area, and vertical circulation improvement and expansion. What we're doing, that diagram is a picture of the front of our Terminal 1. We're adding 15 feet onto the front of that building. We're completely remodeling the ticketing area, the baggage claim area. If you've been to the baggage claim area, it's kind of a dark area. It's got low ceilings. We're adding a couple of feet to those ceilings. We're going to brighten it up. And then in that additional 15 feet, that's going to help us redo all of the escalators and elevators in that area so that people will be able to move much more freely and easily through the different levels between ticketing, baggage handling, ground transportation, and so forth. So that's really going to improve the customer experience as you move through those areas. We are also building a new parking structure, and on the picture on the bottom, that large gray box is a new 5,000-space parking structure. On the top of that picture, to the left, would be where the main terminal is. So to the left of that big gray box would be the additional parking structures that we currently have, and then the terminal. But underneath that gray box is currently our exit plaza where you pay for your parking tickets. So we're actually moving that out to the far right of the screen where you see the kind of the white area is going to be our new exit plaza. We're in the midst of constructing that currently. And then once that exit plaza opens, we'll start on that new parking ramp. We're scheduled to bid that ramp in, I believe, June of this year, and open that new ramp will be sometime in 2019. But that's a $293 million project. I should have mentioned, going back to the first project, the vertical circulation project, we're spending about $43 million on that this year. It's going to be phased over 5 years and will be about a $400 million project when it's all said and done. And then the final project I'll talk about is a new hotel. I think this has been discussed for many years. There are a lot of major hub airports that do have hotels on their facility. This is a 300-room intercontinental hotel that's being developed by Graves Hospitality. This will be a wonderful addition from a customer service standpoint, that individuals can fly in and spend a night in the hotel, or when they're departing, spend a night here and take an early morning flight out and easily access the airport concourses and concessions and all of that. As part of this hotel, the MAC is investing in a skyway system that will go from the hotel over to Concourse C, and that's about a $17 million project that will have a TSA checkpoint in it so that if you're staying in the hotel, you can clear security right as you exit the hotel. So, again, That is currently being constructed. You'll see a crane on site, and where that crane is where that hotel is going to be built. So from a future standpoint, we've, you know, if you look back from 2007 to 2016, we spent about $1.3 billion on capital improvements throughout our airports, the majority of that obviously being on Minneapolis. We're currently moving into another phase of substantial investment. You know, the projects I talked about were really the kind of some of the anchor projects moving forward. We'll spend about $450 million in 2017 alone, and we're projecting about $1.6 billion over the next 6 years. And then if you take our projects identified in our current long-term comprehensive plan, that number gets up to about $2.5 billion in 2035. So very airports are, as you know, very capital-intensive facilities, and that's no different here in Minneapolis. We're almost done here, so I think, you know, really when you look at airports, I refer to airports as economic engines. These numbers are based on a study that was done in 2012 really indicated that the facility generated about $10.1 billion annually in total economic output. About $611 million in tax revenues, $5.7 billion in direct economic impact, $3 billion in employee earnings. It touches about 76,000 jobs when you multiply the impact those 20,000 jobs have at Minneapolis, and about $1.9 billion in visitor spending. This was, again, a study that was accomplished in 2012. It's somewhat outdated, and we're going to be updating this actually this year, and so we'll have some new numbers to report at the end of next year. But as I talked about with the air service initiatives, it's critical that we continue to focus and invest on and work with our airline partners on air service and air service development, while at the same time ensuring that we are being sensitive to the environment and that we continue to invest in our noise mitigation program to do all we can to allow this asset to survive here and be a good neighbor to our surrounding communities. And that is it. I'm happy to answer any other or respond to any other questions if there may be any others.
For Mr. Reichs, I do think there's a couple. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Reichs, thank you for your presentation. Very thorough and informative. In regards to parking, I'm happy to hear that the expansion of the parking certainly has always been a struggle at parking, both ramps, or sometimes you have to go over to the Terminal 2 because there's no parking at Terminal 1. And certainly for a traveler, there's a lot of walking, especially with luggage and equipment when you travel. So you better be in shape to be walking not only from the parking ramp to the airport, but then navigate through the airport. So happy to see the expansion of the parking. But even with that, as we park in that new gray area they had in that slide, there's quite a bit of distance to get to the airport. Have you addressed that in the past, or are you going to address it in the future? And does the airport offer a valet parking? So if a passenger can drive up his vehicle, unload, and I know other airports around our country has some of that service available, that great customer service. Has the airport looking at that? Have they done that before? And then just how to navigate from the parking to even the check-in could be a four-block walk or longer.
Right.
Mr. Reichs.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, thank you for those questions. I think when you mention the walking distances, that's, you know, we're involved in it's a World Airport Survey process where we're graded, and we come out very well in the majority of those survey areas, with the exception of one, and it's our walking distances. And so we've implemented people mover systems, the tram along Concourse C as well, But that is a challenge, frankly, given the layout of the facility, and we're going to continue to invest, ensure that the trams are operating as efficiently as possible, and that wherever there's the ability to assist with people movers, that we can do that. You mentioned valet parking. We do have valet parking at the facility. I think we've got about 450 parking spots that are actually underneath the facility. You have to go through a security protocol to gain access to that, but it is a nice option for those that want to take advantage of that. But the walking distance is something that we'll continue to be focused on and look at any potential innovations in technology to improve that situation.
Can you follow up?
Yeah, just one quick, because I know Representative Posnick wants to speak as well. So in the investment, the $1.6 billion in the next 6 years, does that translate to a ticket? Do you have to expense that to the tickets? Will that reflect on the price of the tickets as going forward as you continue to invest that into the airport?
Mr. Rice.
Madam Chair and Representative McDonald, we really don't anticipate that occurring. I mean, we do have, to some extent, potentially, we do receive some of our revenue through a passenger facility charge. However, that charge is regulated by Congress. It's currently a $4.50 charge. It's been the passenger facility charge has been in effect since 1992. And so whether or not that'll change, it's really a matter as to whether Congress will allow airports to increase. But we don't expect it, to increase much at this point. There's also a customer facility charge, and that's a fee that's primarily tacked onto rental cars to help pay for the rental car facilities that they occupy. But other than that, we really don't expect that our improvements here will have an impact on airline fares. That's solely as long as we keep our airline costs low, we don't expect the airlines, hopefully, to pass that on to you. The airlines, I think, look at the fares more on a global network and a competitive network, meaning if as long as we have competition going to different routes, those fares should remain competitive. However, if there isn't competition on a route, I think we all know that we see a little higher airfare in some of those circumstances.
Representative Posnick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just kind of curious a little bit about the parking, the busing into the airports. What providers are allowed into the airports? I know we've had some discussion in the past about taxis and the transportation network providers, but can you tell the committee a little bit about which busing authorities are and what the system is there?
Mr. Rice.
Madam Chair and Representative, I don't know that we really have any restrictions on who can access the airport. We do charge, obviously, fees for that access. And so from a hotel shuttle or a regional shuttle coming from or van service coming from Duluth or St. Cloud or Rochester or Alexandria, they all have access and frankly many of them have very strong business models based on that access. As far as TNCs, the transportation network companies, the Ubers and Lyfts, we recently passed an ordinance to allow and to really structure that access. We've also recently updated our taxi ordinance, and we wanted to really maintain as level of a playing field as possible, both for the TNCs and the taxi environment. Those ordinances are being implemented as we speak. The latest number that I had heard is that we were up to about 2,500 daily TNC operations at the facility. So I think the way we look at those things is that if there's a demand and we can serve a role from a customer service standpoint and the customers want that, we will do all we can to accommodate existing or new service based on new technology.
Very good. Thank you.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for you regarding a trip I recently took. I couldn't quite figure out what was happening. It was early in the morning, and we were tired and traveling as a family. When we got into the airport, we were able to check our luggage right away in a real confined space that didn't have very good wayfinding or nowhere to go. Is that temporary, or is that the vision that you're moving towards? Do you know what I'm talking about,
Mr. Riggs?
Madam Chair and Representative, was it underneath, like in the ground transportation, the lower level underneath the roadway? There is some delta. I'm not sure what airline you were traveling on, but.
It was on Delta, and it was just like when we walked in, we immediately had the opportunity to check our bags, but it wasn't clear if you were. My husband has higher status, if you like wait in line and then go up, or if you, it was really confusing. But I mean, it was a nice option, but it was really confusing, congested, and I was just wondering if that's temporary or that's what you're moving towards,
Mr. Riggs.
Madam Chair and Representative, I believe you're talking about an area that's underground as you're coming from the parking structure that actually has been there for quite some time. And I think was installed as another option, rather than to be able for individuals coming from the parking facilities instead of having to go up to the main ticketing area. So that's been there for some time, and I believe that will continue to be there. But I'll certainly make a note of the wayfinding and see if we can make some improvements there.
Thank you. All right, Representative Mason. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of comments. This is, to me, one of the most attractive airports out there, and it's always very easy to get around. And more than that, I think the people that work there go out of their way to be very helpful, and I definitely appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Seeing no other questions, thank you very much, Mr. Reichs, for your presentation. And as Representative Mason just said, I mean, it reminds us how really what a valuable asset and how well run and planned it is. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, we're going to move on. I believe we have Commissioner Zelli here, and we're going to get a real quick overview of transportation. About as quick as it can be done, I have a feeling. Good afternoon. Some of us are seeing you for the second time in a few days.
It's so a great. Pleasure to be back, Madam Chair.
Wonderful to have you.
Well, I'm going to give an overview and then really get into the meat of the presentation, which is some of our policy recommendations before this panel. So,
Commissioner, that's just a gorgeous photo. That's not Minnesota, though, is it?
It is. At the St. Louis River.
Is it?
Eric's going to. You're going to tell me if I'm correct. Yeah.
Representative Sundin said their district.
Yeah, I believe it's Jay Cook Park, and it was subject of some flooding.
Correct.
A few years ago, so we ended up reconstructing some of these bridges and roads through
correct.
A very scenic part of Minnesota. I recommend it to anybody.
All right. Well, please introduce yourself and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you. I'm Charlie Zelli, Commissioner of the Department of Transportation. It's an honor to see all of you. I know this might be information that some of you have heard before, so I will be moved with dispatch through this overview. I must say it's an honor to follow Brian Riggs. I was on his hiring committee and have following his career for some time. We have a great airport and also a wonderful staff there. We work cooperatively with the MAC, separate agency. But at his point that's a great economic engine is certainly true. Also say that's true for all the modes throughout the entire state of Minnesota. If you were to put all the assets for the Minnesota government on a balance sheet, the transportation assets would represent over 80% of the assets of the state. So it shows how important the work of this committee and the work we do. MnDOT actually was created in the 70s, but it was bringing together a lot of different departments related to transportation. So we really achieved this multimodal vision, including aeronautics, in the 70s. But, of course, from going back to the roots of the highway department, it's nearly 100 years old. We have a vision which isn't about just protecting these assets, although it is. It's about people's lives based upon surveys of all Minnesotans, what people care about when they think about transportation. It's the health of our people, the environment, and our economy, and really to underscore the foundation that all these assets provide for our economy. It's also part of our livability, our personal health, and we see that as a kind of a guiding principle for how we program our work. We have, of course, guided by values. Safety is always on top. It is not the reason we exist, but as we exist, we try to do everything as safely as possible and with integrity. And diversity inclusion has become a major focus recently for all of state government. I will say it's been very much part of MnDOT for a number of years, and not just because it's the right thing, but because if we are going to have a workforce that reflects Minnesota citizens, if we're able to serve all Minnesotans, we need to be really proactive and think about how we can be culturally more receptive, respectful, and open so we can be more effective as an enterprise. We're divided into 8 sections, so we are certainly comprehensive throughout the state. Each district has its own district engineer, but we have some centralized planning, some centralized way of ensuring consistency, but very much of a local presence in each of these districts. The largest in terms of dollars is, of course, the Metro District, representing about half of the financing, but not in geography. We have many multimodal services that refer to it. Clearly, most of the dollars are in programming, constructing, and operating a state highway system, but we work through our state aid programs with counties and municipal roads throughout the state. As I mentioned, the multimodal, we actually have separate division offices, an office of aeronautics. We have Greater Minnesota Transit and passenger rail, and work with ports and freight logistics as well. What's often missed is we actually construct and manage the emergency communication systems. The ARMOR system is part of our state aid organization. I mentioned highways. The trunk highway system operates as much as 59 billion annual vehicle miles, or I'm sorry, 33 billion vehicle miles a year out of the total 59 billion. And to give you a context, the trunk highway system represents approximately 12,000 miles out of 144,000 miles that are all of the roadways in the state of Minnesota. We have a very robust system. It is at every level of government. It's probably the fifth largest roadway system in the United States.
Commissioner, I would just like to pause a moment and ask, what is the methodology for calculating the miles traveled? Because that's things in the roadway, or I mean, how does that number come together?
Well, in some highways we do have studies with things in the roadway, mm-hmm. but more often we actually determine average daily traffic on different segments, and I believe this is an estimate based upon real data and then some extrapolations. We probably have much better data on the trunk highway system than we do on local roads, but it's we have both the economists and planners who kind of work on these estimates.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. To continue.
As you can see, we have maybe 54, easily over half the vehicle miles in the state operate out of that, just that 5% of roadways, which is the trunk highway system, and that involves interstates, all of our major highways that MnDOT has primary responsibility for. We're also the land of a lot of bridges, 20,000 bridges over 10 feet. We have nearly 5,000 somehow relate to either are or go over a trunk highway system. So that is an area of primary concern. Although we inspect all bridges, we maintain and manage the trunk highway bridge system. We spent a lot of time talking about the MAC and the reliever airports of that system. There are 135 airports in the state of Minnesota, so actually a pretty robust system of general aviation. Seven of those are MAC, as we discussed, but nine have commercial airline service, and some of those are essential air service locations, certainly Duluth, Bemidji, you're aware of, Brainerd.
Commissioner, we do have a question. Representative Hertaz.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner Zelli. Just a couple of things just kind of touched me when you were talking about the percentage of miles in our roadway and the amount of passenger miles driven. And you mentioned some pretty staggering statistics in terms of how many total passenger miles are driven on a pretty vibrant transportation system. Given that disproportion, I'm wondering what your comments are about what appears to be a disproportionate amount of capital investments being made in other areas of transportation in which most people do not use. It appears that when we're talking about a 10-year plan and a $6 billion transportation funding package, that we're talking about spending a third or more of money in an area in which, at best, maybe handles 2% or 3% of ridership. That seems to be in direct conflict with where people are using the system and where investments need to be made. What is your thoughts about that in your budget as dollars are being appropriated?
He's got a frown on his face.
No, Madam Chair, Representative, I guess I'm not aware of only 2% that receives $2 billion. So I guess I'm curious maybe to ask you to clarify what is it you're addressing.
Well,
Representative Hertaz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Zelli, we're talking currently quite a hot topic and debate about expansion of light rail.
Oh.
And we're talking about billions of dollars of investment, of which projections show that by 2040, at best, would maybe be handling 3% of ridership. So when you're talking about 12,000 miles of road, accumulating the vast majority of ridership and where people need the flexibility and the convenience of determining routes to changing jobs and changing locations and daycare providers and different things that ordinary people do, and I agree with you that transportation really is the economic engine of our economy. I mean, people meeting people is a contact sport in which dollars change hands. So I'm just curious, as commissioner, what you think about what appears to be a disproportionate allocation of money in an area where most people don't go.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative, I actually appreciate the question because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding with numbers. First, capital investment versus operating costs. The fact that highly traveled corridors, such as we have in the metro, and is addressed in part by light rail investments, actually are the densest, most expensive part of our statewide system. So none of the funding for light rail comes from any of the trunk highway resources, but they very much augment the costs and the capacity that is limited given the footprints we have in the urban area. So all these modes actually serve together to create much more efficiency and the important purpose, which is access to employers, access to jobs, and efficient mobility. So light rail by itself probably isn't as best understood other than think of it as a larger puzzle, a network of bus systems, light rail, rapid bus transit, roadways. In fact, roadways are often the conduit from which transit ways are developed. But in the case of some light rail corridors in this metro area, the actual capacity cannot be addressed by roadways alone. So, in fact, we are very supportive and work hand-in-hand with Met Council to gain the greatest efficiency toward moving people. And sometimes these capital amounts are put next to an operating amount, and it's less, it's probably out of context. I know as a bus guy, when I spend $1 million on a bus, wow, that's really expensive. But I think how that's amortized over the life of that bus and serving the different destinations, it starts making more sense. So I'm happy to get deeper into the arithmetic, but I have to tell you from my point of view, very much part of the puzzle that's required for our vibrant infrastructure.
Right, and I'm certainly we'll get into the arithmetic in more detail. Did you have any follow-up, Representative Hertaz?
Yeah, thank you. Well, I thank you for that response, and that was very eloquent in terms of supporting the multimodal system. It didn't really get to the core of my question, but anyway, I'll let you continue with your presentation. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, Commissioner.
Thank you, and I'm always available for more specific questions if I didn't get the answer right. But as we continue on the multimodal theme, obviously freight and freight movements is a growing part of Minnesota's economy, and whereas vehicle miles take a certain amount of capacity are growing in the metro area, they're not growing as much in rural Minnesota. But freight movements is increasing, and we need to look beyond just highways. Waterways are significant conduits for shipping. We're blessed in Minnesota by having deep water ports and in Duluth, where more than just iron ore and taconite, but high-tech wind blades and products from Europe actually come directly into Minnesota, and also a great connection point with rail and with highways. We have waterway ports in Duluth, Winona, Red Wing, and St. Paul. And as I mentioned, rail is also a very robust system in Minnesota. We have more than just the Class 1 railroads. We have as many as 15 small short line rail, which is really important for accessing, particularly in greater Minnesota, the manufacturers and shippers who are able to feed into the large Class 1 system.
And I think we have another question, I guess. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I do remember a couple of years ago where we were asked for more money for the ports to upgrade them. Where are we in that position right now?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, a representative, there are some proposals in the governor's bonding bill, but as there were port funding in the proposals that didn't pass last session, there is always a need. We've been fortunate to receive some Tiger grant funding in the Port of Duluth. There's been obviously more than just federal funds, state funds. There's also private match funds, local funds that have been very helpful in rebuilding and improving our port system. And Duluth may be the largest, but St. Paul, Winona, Red Wing all have active investment proposals.
Thank
you.
Is there a follow-up? Okay. Representative Barr, excuse me.
Madam Chair, with the closing of the St. Anthony Dock, you're talking about waterway travel. What effect did that have on that?
Mr.
Madam Chair, the Port of Minneapolis was very limited. The St. Anthony locks did open up access. There was one particular user, Northern Recycling, I believe, which was a scrap aggregator. They have been handling their business by the highways. My understanding is when the locks closed, the Port of Minneapolis became more valuable real estate for other uses, housing, recreation, and some business development. And I think the city of Minneapolis has been taking a lead to do a whole upper harbor plan, which is opening up that area for more economic development.
Representative Barr.
So thank you, Madam Chair. So there wasn't any, like, grain traveling north of Minneapolis prior to the closing of the dock? I mean, there was only one shipper? That's kind of the question, how many shippers were affected?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, there, I think, was a time when the mills were on the, you know, powered by the falls and the grain was coming down the Mississippi, that those days have long passed. The large barges don't go up north of St. Paul, really. Anyway.
So one. Okay.
Thank you. Yeah.
All right. Please proceed, Commissioner.
Thank you. We have active transit systems in every county in the state, quite apart from the metro area transit, which serves continually growing constituency in greater Minnesota. We have been working to make those systems more efficient while expanding their footprint and their scope. The bike and pedestrian facilities are not just in the metro area. There's a significant amount of trail system and then even urban systems in our regional centers. We actually do have two U.S. bike routes, and the one U.S. Bike Route 41 from St. Paul going north through Canada, through Duluth up to Canada is really opening this spring. A continuing refrain you'll hear from me and many others is that our system is deteriorating faster than we can keep pace. Part of that is because of the great expansion that happened over 50 years ago, means that more over 50% of our state highway pavements are over 50 years old, and bridges are in a similar condition. I'd like to say they're in good shape, but the trajectory of the reconstruction that's required is becoming more pronounced. That and the fact that our resources are diminishing and not keeping pace with inflation, partly because of the fuel tax, which is a big share of our funding, is fixed related to the amount of fuel that's consumed rather than the price or the need for our system. This is the chart that really shows what our state road construction program has been on an annual basis, and then the outlook in the next 3 years. We've been talking about this funding drop of almost 30% for a number of years, and we're now on it. This is happening starting July 1st. Where we will have significantly less. You'll see these green bars here represent borrowings that have been paid from the gas tax increase in 2008. It was the Chapter 152 program which authorized about over $2 billion of funding specifically focused on a bridge reconstruction and to bring our bridges up to good repair. So we definitely have the need in this billion or more level every year, but we will start constricting our program soon. So get more specific about the gap in funding, we have under our current program over the next 10 years about $8.5 billion of preservation and very little program for expansion. Expansion means new lanes, new interchanges. The fact is we can't keep pace with the funding required for preservation, so there is very little left for doing those, additional lanes, both Greater Minnesota and in the metro. The gap is, for the next 10 years, we think is a reasonable level at $6 billion, leaving $4 billion to keep pavements in the same condition as they are and the bridges in good repair, but $2 billion gap in what could be reasonably expected for strategic expansion. That's interchanges, lanes, and some of those bottlenecks and two-lane to four-lane completions that we see around the state. This is the perfect storm why $6 billion is really needed. Increased population. The weather has not been our friend. The volatility of weather has almost been as bad as the lows. It's more that the jumps from 40 degrees yesterday to maybe below zero next week, who knows? That's very hard on transportation systems. And then, of course, we have an increased cost of construction every year. If we do not fund what we call the next 10-year program, we will have eroding pavements and bridges that could be structurally deficient. One thing to note is because of federal guidelines and requirements, we will have to focus our available resources on maintaining the highest trafficked roads. That's the interstates and some of the major arterials, mostly around the metro area. The roads in the greater Minnesota will suffer more over the next 10 to 20 years and become in a greater disrepair compared to the rest of the state. With the $6 billion of funding for the trunk highway system, we will be able to improve 1,700 additional miles of pavement and 235 bridges. We will be able to complete some of those corridors of commerce. That's the expansion programs of lanes and interchanges, and remove key bottlenecks. So we know that there's always more projects than we would be able to cover. We know that there's always a greater list, but we have identified that $6 billion as a prudent, not world-class, but prudent, competitive funding to keep our system viable. Just quick illustrations of what eroding pavement looks like. I think everybody probably knows, but this is what happens. Cracks appear, water seeps into them, and then it's really what happens underneath pavements that really is what we should focus on. And when we think about bridges, we inspect bridges every year, and we do spot checks, we do spot repairs. We find it is far more efficient and more prudent to make the refurbishments in bridges and roads as well at the right time so that we could extend the life of the asset. We can make it last a lot longer if we get into key refurbishments. And that's illustrated by this graph that really shows you can keep that bridge going for decades longer if we just take care of it and make the necessary repairs so it doesn't erode to a point where we have to replace the whole bridge.
Commissioner, it looks like we have another question. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Gizelli, on this two slides back, the remaining service life, I want to ask that, you know, this, as you know, this is as clear as mud for me. I keep trying to understand this more and more, and it's never becomes totally clear. But this is what I want to understand, and the committee, this might be helpful for the committee too. So you rate, our bond rating is rated on smoothness, and if you look at that, it tends to be quite more green than the remaining service life in the state. And so I always have the thing, if we're chasing only smoothness, we're not really addressing what's underneath the smoothness, which is remaining service life. And I don't necessarily know if the public realizes the dire need of our infrastructure because they have many smooth roads in Minnesota, but don't know the dire need underneath. So this is my question. I'm interested in performance measures, as I know you feel this is a good measure as well. I want to know, you're able to measure this and put this on this map. What does MnDOT do as far as measuring this in setting goals to improve the remaining service life in our state? Can you help me in the committee understand what role that plays in the work you do and what role it could play in the work you do?
Well, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi, the remaining service life is a great concept because it's not just measuring how smooth the road is. It is what is really underneath the pavement in terms of how long we can expect it to last. Mm-hmm. And if we're being smart and prudent, as you point out, we should not just have a thin overlay that lasts a few years. Let's reconstruct the road, which takes more money, mm-hmm. but it lasts a lot longer. And the reality is it's a balance because at a certain point, a mill and overlay is a prudent investment because that road has a good foundation and it will last a lot longer. Sometimes you'll find roads that don't look like they're in great shape. They have zero remaining service life, and it is truly wasteful to put either concrete or asphalt over roadway that is already that really requires total reconstruction. Mm-hmm. So we have asset plans and performance measures a lot on pavement because it drives so much of our funding. As you rightfully point out, we should be looking at it over the long term, not just what's the next few years look like, because you can kind of kick that can down the proverbial road and not make enough investment. So clearly, being short of capital requires you to make short-term fixes, which are not in the best interests of Minnesota's or the system.
So, Commissioner, then maybe to follow up, so the pavement condition report that comes out annually, is that right?
Yeah.
Does it, so it is measuring the it's a comprehensive measurement of the road and its quality and condition. So it's more than the appearance. It is the actual foundation and so on.
Well, I think that there's a number of factors, and smoothness mm-hmm. is a factor, and we have people and vans that measure the surface quality. Mm-hmm. But I think that it is related, and we go deeper if not with specific measurements, but with at least some smart engineering estimates as to what the life of a roadway is. It changes every year because of certain weather dynamics, road use patterns. They're always changing, so it's not where you can accurately predict this particular pavement will last this many years, but as a whole, they're fairly accurate estimates if you start aggregating quite a few pavements over a period of time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thank you.
Yep.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't catch what measurement that you were talking about. We were talking about at the end of the year something comes out. Well, can you just share with me so I'm on the same page?
Representative, I believe and I've seen, I guess, this pavement report. I don't know if it's, you know, multiple pages or if it's, you know, just a brochure. I frankly don't know that, but I have read some portions of a pavement report.
Okay.
And maybe we could get some clarification.
We'll get that, Madam Chair. We'll get that information for you.
Okay. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. And do proceed, Commissioner.
I mentioned the reactive bridge maintenance. A few years ago, we had thought I-35 just south of Duluth was in great shape, and we do a bridge inspection getting underneath the hard-to-get area and realize that it is eroding to a point of being unsafe. We closed Interstate 35 and did an emergency repair, so part of our budget framework needs to always have some flexibility in order to put resources toward investments that we had not anticipated but are really necessary. I have to mention, and I think I've been very much of a focus for the past 4 years, is ensuring that we're not just running the program but running it like a business to find every efficiency measurable that we can. And the reason we say effective is because sometimes the investments that make a lot of sense cost 15 or 18% more. I'll pick on aluminized pipes last four times as long as galvanized pipes, but they cost 18% more. So we're measuring not just pavement, but all the assets, rolling stock, trucks, to make sure that we are being thoughtful about the life cycle cost. And we also are looking and we're measuring ways to find efficiencies and actually reduce budgets, free up funding that we're able to deploy to other projects that otherwise couldn't be funded. So we have now started making an annual report to the legislature, and we can show you that where we've been able to measure in terms of additional resources gained from efficiencies on an annual basis. So now we're getting into the policy proposals, and I'm joined by Eric Rudin, who we can kind of go through some of the details of each of these policy proposals, and I'll sit here and answer any questions.
Good afternoon, Mr. Rudin. Please state your name for the record and do begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Eric Rudin with MnDOT Government Affairs. So the first proposal you'll see there contains two provisions related to bicycles. And the first one is to update bicycle laws that in large part were enacted in the 1970s and haven't really been updated since then. And then the second part of the proposal the Commissioner referenced earlier, creating a new bikeway from St. Paul to Canada through Duluth, which we're referring to as the North Star route. The second group of bills there would be standalone bills, the first of which is for drones, and the department currently regulates drones with existing law, but those laws were not really written with drones in mind, so we're looking for specific authority on drone regulation and proposing a $25 annual registration fee, which is actually a reduction from current law, which has a minimum $100 annual registration fee. And unmanned aircraft systems used for recreational purposes would be exempt from that requirement. The next provision relates to flaggers in work zones, and we've had an increasing number of incursions in our work zones, which is a big safety concern to us. So this proposal is modeled after some existing law for school bus arms. If you drive around a stop sign on a school bus, you can be cited by law enforcement for up to 4 hours after that incident occurs. And so our proposal is to mirror that for flaggers, so that if somebody drives around a stop sign in a work zone, that license plate number could be reported to law enforcement, and then they would have up to 4 hours to issue a citation. The next one would update outdoor advertising regulations. And again, this is a situation where state laws haven't been updated for many years. And so we've worked with the outdoor advertising industry on these proposals, and we feel they're pretty comfortable with where we're at with this proposal. But again, it's really just updating state law to bring us into conformance with federal law. And if we do not stay in conformance with federal law, the Federal Highway Administration could revoke up to 10% of our federal highway funding. Then we have a right-of-way bill, which contains a few different elements, the first of which is just really a technical cleanup on an old legislative route number for Legislative Route 101. The second two are trunk highway turnbacks, and this is where we take something that's currently a trunk highway and turn jurisdiction over to a local unit of government. And since all the trunk highways are listed in statute, we have to bring these forward for your approval, and we don't bring these forward until the local governments are supportive of these proposals. And so one is in Le Sueur County and one is in Becker County. The next one would allow us to do what's called an over-the-counter sale of property. And if we have a public bid and don't receive any bids for a parcel of property, this would allow us to list that parcel on a website. And then if anybody from the public was interested in purchasing that, they could come in and pay us the fair market value for that property without us having to go through another public bid. And this is a model that the DNR uses for selling their excess property. And then the final one there is transferring some trunk highway right-of-way to the Minnesota Historical Society up in northern Minnesota on the Canadian border where there's an Indian burial ground. And then we would also have a policy bill that would contain a few provisions. The first two are federal conformity Those of you might be familiar with the DMLR provision, which allows that if you're in a 55-mile-an-hour zone, you can go up to 10 miles an hour over the speed limit. And if you're cited for speeding in that 10-mile-an-hour window, the violation does not go on your driving record. And the federal government considers this masking the record or kind of hiding the true driving record, and so they do not allow that for holders of commercial driver's licenses. And we've discovered that state law has a loophole for a learner's permit for somebody that's pursuing a commercial driver's license, so we need to close that loophole. The second one is for pipeline welding trucks. This is a new federal provision, and we have 3 years to exempt pipeline welding trucks from certain regulations. Statewide plan due dates. This is for the statewide multimodal transportation plan as well as the 20-year capital highway investment plan, and we're proposing to update those every 5 years instead of every 4 years, as is currently required. Commercial vehicle inspectors, there was a lawsuit a few years ago where the authority of state commercial vehicle inspectors was challenged, and so this is just to clarify in state law that, that people who are not state patrol troopers can, in fact, stop a vehicle and perform a commercial vehicle inspection. The next provision you may have heard of, this is another federal conformity issue, but it allows trucks that are hauling milk to carry heavier weights on interstates. And in the past, we had allowed those on state highways, but they were not allowed on federal interstates. So our proposal would also allow them on interstates. The federal government has set a deadline of December 2019 to install yield signs at all railroad grade crossings that don't have other markings such as a stop sign or gate arms or something. So we're looking to put that into state law. And then the last one is removing a sunset on a bid preference. For projects that are 100% state funded, we offer a 6% bid preference for targeted group businesses and veteran-owned businesses. And that provision currently is scheduled to sunset 8 years after May 1st, 2012, and so we're proposing to eliminate that sunset.
Very good. Mr. Rudin, any member questions? Representative McDonald, did you have one?
Yeah, thank you. Commissioner Zelli, before you build that trail, bike trail from Minnesota to Canada, question for you. I want to thank you for the work you did for the corridor, the most dangerous corridor in Minnesota, Highway 12. I represent Wright County. I live in Delano. So my loved ones, myself and family and most people I know travel that often. And as you know and aware of, it is a very dangerous stretch of highway, over 20 killed in 5 years. Okay. Very dangerous, and I'd like to thank you and the MnDOT for their good work that they did last year. Although Representative Hertaus's bill for some appropriations did not pass, or it passed through the House, but it didn't get through a transportation committee or a transportation bill. We did, MnDOT worked with the Highway 12 Coalition with Representative Hertaus and Senator Osmark's work and found some monies to help fix one of the most dangerous corridors in Minnesota. And since then, we've had no fatalities. So I want to thank you and MnDOT, the gentleman from District 3, which is the Delano area from St. Cloud. We're in that district. Really worked very well, the engineers and MnDOT, to really help find some funds when there was none available here at the Capitol. Us politicians couldn't get the damn job done, but MnDOT did. So they got the job done, found the appropriations, and put in a barrier along Highway 12 and fixed 92 and 90 intersections. However, it's not done yet, and I believe Representative Hertaus has a bill. And we just plead with you to continue to work with us so we can make sure that there are no more deaths on what the media has called, and those down here, the most dangerous stretch of highway in the state of Minnesota. So have you any comment on that, Commissioner Zelli?
Madam Chair, Representative, I really appreciate you acknowledging that. We found available funding for the most efficient next step in the Highway 12 solution. It is clearly a priority for us and the agency, and I appreciate working with the coalition over the years, and constructing the median, you know, was clearly a great step. It is not finished. We know there's still a dangerous interchange. That interchange is actually involves Hennepin County in addition to the trunk highway system, so it's a more complicated both funding and jurisdictional puzzle to solve. But I think we're certainly committed to seeing it through. I think over the years we've tried rumble strips, we've tried different things, but enforcement, awareness, but there's nothing like putting a nice layer of concrete to separate the lanes, and that seems to have really helped. But we know there's more, and there's dangerous interchanges and byways throughout the state, and they are on our radar. And I just a comment on the U.S. bike trail, that is signing existing roadways. We're not marching through with new trails. Just give a sense of where that is. Okay.
All right, Representative Barr.
You had said it. Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. You had said in a previous presentation that your focus was on being competitive versus being cutting edge. And then today I heard you talk about looking at initiatives and things to help ensure that we have access to jobs and efficiencies.
Right.
And so one of my questions was really, you know, getting to some of these bike paths and things. And I have seen situations where we have eliminated turning lanes to put in bike paths and some of those things. How does that fit in with what you're saying? How do you use that competitive versus cutting edge and access to jobs and efficiency when you're making decisions for how you're prioritizing projects?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative, I actually think it's very consistent. We very rarely will work in the community but with our own standards. It's very much in collaboration with the local government, like a city, town, and certainly a business community, a chamber. And I look to, in greater Minnesota, what we accomplished in Alexandria or St. Peter, upcoming Redwood Falls, where we have, in some cases, rebuilt a roadway along with the city while they're doing their utility work, so it becomes less sidewalk to sidewalk, more curb to curb. I'm sorry, not curb to curb, but building to building. And think about the livability of the community, because our state highway is actually a Main Street retail area. So how do we make it more livable to help enhance retail for that local community? And so in many cases, that might be bike lanes. It might be wider sidewalks. And I actually look to those communities where they've been great successes embraced by the local retail and business communities. So, look, we now have a much more livable city. People are coming in into downtown to shop in ways that they weren't in the past. And in Austin, Minnesota, I was part of a think tank where they were looking at trying to develop a hub for transportation. I thought we were talking about cars. It actually was a bike hub, because they saw the resurgence of shopping going on in neighboring Lanesboro. So the Hormel Foundation, the mayor, the city engineer, and our MnDOT folks were saying, how will this work to best support both the efficiency and the livability and ultimately the prosperity of that community? We have certainly at times widen lanes, times we restrict lanes. Oddly enough, in the case of Redwood Falls, we'll go from four lanes to three lanes, which is very controversial, and it took a lot of time for people to think about it. But by having a center lane, which is a left turn lane, it suddenly took those traffic that was blocking trucks coming through town and allowed for the free mobility in the open lane, and with synchronized lights, actually produces less congestion than there was without the proper striping. So I think traffic, and believe me, I'm not a traffic engineer, but I've learned that sometimes it's not the easy answer. It's kind of looking deeper, and how do we actually make all these different modes come together? And there really is some win-win opportunities, and that's what we're committed to.
Representative Posnick? Okay. All right. So, members, we thank you, first of all, for your presentations. We're enlightened now, I'm certain. So thank you very, very much. And that concludes our agenda for today, members. Our next meeting is Wednesday the 25th, and we are adjourned.
Thank you so much.